Okay, so I was thinking a little bit about what we can do today, and I did want to spend some time on looking at the symbols of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur from the perspective of the Kabbalah. We looked last time, we learned about what Yirat Hashem is. So now we know that Yirat Hashem is not being afraid of God, it's being afraid of being separated from God. And that really makes all the difference. So that when you come to the High Holy Days, what you're really coming to, not afraid of what's going to happen during the next year, just wanting to be closer. And I feel that that is such a different perspective. So that's one thing. And the other thing I wanted to do was to look at some of the language and the symbols which are associated with Rosh Hashanah. Now, I had a look in the Zohar this morning. Unfortunately, the pieces in the Zohar, which explain things, are somewhat difficult in the Zohar. So I thought I'd just start off by just talking, and you can make notes or something as you go along. And the first thing I want to start off is actually looking at the name Rosh Hashanah. And we're looking at the word Rosh, head. Now, Rosh, we normally translate that as the new year. In actual fact, Rosh means the head of the year. Rosh is the Hebrew term for head. Okay. And the Zohar teaches us that the year is one spiritual entity. Okay, it's one whole spiritual entity. And every spiritual entity has a head part and a body part. Okay, and the head part is the potential aspect, and the body part is where the light actually comes into the vessel. And it's the actualization of what the head part does. So
Would
if,
you repeat that? Because I was writing. So the head part is what and the body part is what?
right. Well, I am recording it also, so I'll make sure to put it up for you as well.
Okay, good.
Okay, but you're right, it's good to write it down. The head part is the potential aspect,
Potential.
yeah, and the body aspect is the actualization.
And you said something about light?
Yeah, so in the head part, the spiritual aspect, the spiritual entity thinks about or makes the a calculation about how much light it can receive for the sake of giving, and that amount of light it will receive, and what it can't receive for the sake of giving, it leaves alone, and it makes that idea, it gets that idea first, and then it carries it out in practice. And that's how the spiritual entities work. And again, like ourselves, we have a mind which thinks and plans and works things out. And when we have a clear idea of what we feel we need, then we can actualize those needs. But until we have that, thought there, we can't do anything in practice. So you have a potential aspect of the spiritual entity, and you have an actual aspect of the spiritual entity. So the term Rosh Hashanah is actually very significant. It's telling you that there's a potential aspect to the new year, and that on the new year, we get the potential for spiritual work, which is then enacted during the whole of the year. I think in some respects, this is echoed in the Christian tradition by New Year's resolutions. And it's customary for people to think about their lives and make a resolution about what they want to do for the rest of the year. I think that's come from a certain way from the Jewish idea of the new year, that the new year is a day in which we have this potential, and then for the rest of the year it comes into action. Now, a potential for what? We'll get back to that in a moment. The other word of the Rosh Hashanah is, of course, the word Shana, which means a year. It means something that repeats itself. As, for example, in the Shema, we say, Vashinantam Levanecha, and you should repeat it again to your children, like, and the Shanen, to repeat something over and over. So it's got the concept, the connotation of something that comes round again and again and again. Okay, something which, the cycle of the year, comes round again and again. Nevertheless, the Zohar teaches us that every single year is a new year. It adds another dimension to the work of Tikkun that has already happened. It seems to go around the same sort of cycle of the year, you know, New Year, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Chanukah, Purim, Pesach, Shavuot, Elul, and back round again. So we have the cycle of the year in which the equivalent energies come at their right times during the year, and yet every single time it's a new work, it's a new tikkun, it's a new dimension. So the word shana has that aspect of new and of repetition. If we look in the physical world at what this resembles, it's very clear. It's like the rings on a tree. Every year the tree adds another ring within itself and it grows, and yet it's the same. It's that same circle. It's the same circle of the tree, and yet each year it's added this extra ring, which it was not there before. So the same for us. We go around the cycle of the year, and every year we reenact the energies, and yet they are new each time. So we need to ask ourselves, what is the energy that comes into the world on Rosh Hashanah? It's a reenaction of the creation. Now, I was looking this up in the Zohar this morning in order to prepare for this lesson, to find out what precise part of creation is the energy that is reenacted on Rosh Hashanah. And the energy that's reenacted on Rosh Hashanah is the energy of the fourth day of creation in the creation story, which is the two lights. God created the great lights in the heavens. And the day, people say, now it's a little different depending on where you look. There's different places apparently in the Gemara which seems to suggest that it's the seventh day of creation in when Adam and Eve was born, and other places suggest that it's the fourth day of creation where the two lights are created. I don't think it's that crucial personally. Both of these things are connected with the Malchut. It's just different ways of looking at it. So I'm happy to go along with the piece I read this morning, which is the fourth day of creation. And what happens on the fourth day of creation is that God created the two great lights, the sun and the moon, and they put them in the heavens. Now, if we look in the Bible, we would see that the way it's written, the two great lights, is written with the vav, which is one of the letters which forms a vowel, O, is only hinted at with a dot rather than written out fully. Looks a bit odd. The great commentators and the Kabbalists, of course, understood in a meaning of that. And it's the story of the diminishing of the moon. I don't know if you've ever heard this story, but if you haven't, I shall tell it to you. It's a story which appears in the Midrash. It also appears in the Gemara. And it appears a lot in the Zohar. And the idea is that when the moon and the sun first came forth, they were of equal size. And then the moon said, two kings cannot wear one crown. So God said, go and diminish yourself then. And so the moon became smaller and only received its light from the sun. Now, the inner meaning of this story is very pertinent to what happens on Rosh Hashanah, interestingly enough. Although, of course, it's true that the moon is smaller than the sun and receives its light from the sun, the inner meaning is not, in fact, to do with the sun and the moon, or it might be as well, but its inner meaning is far more profound. The inner meaning is like this. The Sphira of Malchut, which is the Sphira that we, as created souls, belong to, and the Sphira above us, which is called Tiferet or Zerampin, both receive their light from Bina, which is the Sphira of giving. Now, the Malchut has the will to receive. That's its vessels. And the Tiferet, or Zerampin, has the will to give, primarily. So Bina, very naturally, gives her light of giving to Tiferet, and she gives her light of receiving to Malchut, because those are the vessels that Malchut has and those are the vessels that Tiferet has. There's no problem with that. And at that stage, they are two great lights. They both receive light. But there's a problem. The Malchut cannot pass that light on to the souls unless it's first enclosed with the light of giving, with the light of Hasadim. Because the souls, it's too unbalanced for the souls to receive direct light just as the way it is, because we have a will to receive for ourselves alone. So therefore, the souls need that light to come down to them in a balanced way, enclosed with the light of giving. So this is the inner meaning of the accusation of the moon, which represents the Malchut. And it says, two kings cannot use one crown. What he's saying is, look, that's very nice, but I can't use the light like this because I don't have the light of giving. And Bina has given all the light of giving to Tiferet. So the Creator, he doesn't make a punishment. He gives a solution. He says, go below Tiferet and receive through her. In other words, receive the light of giving and receive the light of receiving with it ready wrapped, if you like, ready packaged through Tiferet by going below Tiferet. And that way the souls can receive the light in a balanced way. In the language of Rosh Hashanah, that is the light of receiving is called the light of din, of judgment, because it's very strong. And it's also, in a sense, dangerous because it can't be used. And so the souls are lacking their light because it's too strong for them to use it, and yet its presence is there. It's called the light of din, judgment.
Can you say that again?
Yeah, definitely. Please. Yeah, it's this big light which he receives directly from Bina when it's equal to the level of Tiferet. It's called the light of din. It's got an aspect of judgment, of harshness, of danger, if you like, there, because it's a place where it's so strong that if we were to receive it the way it is, we would straight away use it for our wills to receive ourselves alone. It would cause the shattering of the vessels all over again. It's too big for us. That's the best way I can kind of explain it. Whereas the light of chassadim, the light of giving, which Bina gives to Tiferet, is the light of giving, is the light of compassion, is the light of loving kindness. And by wrapping this very harsh, strong light with this love and with this compassion and with this loving kindness, it means that we can receive the light in a balanced way. Now, these words of judgment and compassion are words that we hear quite a lot on Rosh Hashanah. It's called the Day of Judgment. That's one of its names. And now we can begin to understand why. It's because it's the day when the light of Din, of this very strong light, came into the world originally. And because it's a year goes by, this energy comes round again. And so, as Rosh Hashanah comes, when Rosh Hashanah comes in, we have this very strong light coming into the world. So what does the sages have taught us to do? What did God tell us to do? To blow the shofar. The sound of the shofar is the sound of loving kindness and compassion. When we blow the shofar, we are bringing in the light of loving kindness and compassion into the world. The word sound, kol, in the Kabbalah refers to Zerampin or Tiferet, which is that level. And shofar is the compassion of Bina. It's bringing in this love and compassion and loving kindness so that this harsh light of judgment is immediately wrapped and made safe and balanced for the world. So we have this incredible work that the Jewish people do on Rosh Hashanah. When this very strong energy comes in, we straight away blow the shofar and wrap it with loving kindness. And that's the meaning of the sound of the shofar. It's very amazing, isn't it? I find this very amazing.